Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 83, recorded December 19th, 2012. The Technologizer, Harry McCracken. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com and use the offer code Triangulation. And by Ford, featuring Bliss, the blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert and active park assist. Check out these available features on the 2013 Ford Fusion and 2013 Ford Taurus and learn more at Ford.com/technology. And by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show on the TWiT Network where we get the most interesting people in technology, sit down, spend some time with them. I get to talk to them. You get to talk to them. That's where we get the two legs of the three-legged stool that is triangulation. The third leg is, of course, Mr. Harry McCracken this week. It's great to see you. You've seen, I'm sure, Harry many times on other TWiT shows. We'd love to have him on This Week in Tech. And perhaps you know the name, many years as a tech journalist.
Mm-hmm.
You were editor-in-chief of?
I was at PC World.
PC World.
13 years, I think.
13 years.
It was a long time, like 1994. Onwards.
And I really admired you because just a few years ago, while we were all doing what we're doing, kind of getting into new media, you abandoned PC World and said, I'm going to start a website, Technologizer.
You were a big inspiration for doing that.
Oh, thank you. Because I found it inspiring that you did that.
Wow.
I thought, that's a bold move. That's a gutsy move. And essentially go it alone, right? Technologizer is just you.
It was me and some freelancers who helped out.
Yeah.
But a one-person show in terms of a company. And you actually also helped me start out because you had me on TWiT, I think, right before the site even launched.
That's right.
And I remember at the time I had Twitter set up, so whenever I got a new follower, and I probably had a couple of hundred at the time, I would get an email, and I was on with you, and my inbox exploded, and I turned that off immediately.
We do now warn people, do not have email notifications if you are on our shows.
So you actually helped me get going right before the site was even live.
Good. Well, let's go back a little bit earlier. When did you get into technology?
Well, I don't ever remember not being interested in gadgets, but I got into PCs in 1978.
Because, me too. That was the earliest days you could.
Yeah, that was pretty much when they became kind of semi-mainstream.
The Apple II came out in 77, I think.
Yeah, and the TRS-80, also 77.
So what was your first computer?
And the PET over there was also
Commodore PET.
1977.
Yeah.
My father brought home a TRS-80, and I think up until the time he brought it home, I didn't have a clue what a computer did, really.
How old were you?
I was, I guess, 14.
A perfect age.
Yeah.
Perfect age. So what was it that attracted you when you first started using it? I mean, was it games? For me, it was games.
Games and graphics, basically. I had so little inkling of what computers did. I was not aware that they could do animation. And, of course, the TRS-80 had terrible graphics
and
really bad animation, but it was still exciting.
And it did something.
And then I started typing in the programs and the instruction manual.
Yeah.
And loading programs from cassette tape.
Yeah, me too.
And then I went to a high school, which also had like three or four TRS-80s.
Did you get formal education at the high school, or was it just a hobby? It was a club, right?
No, I mean, there was a computer class, but I came in knowing more than the teacher.
That's still true today, by the way. It's the worst place to get a computer education is high school.
So, yeah, it was sort of a social thing. We had our computer lab, which for a time was literally in a closet. And then it moved into a classroom, and we would basically hang out and program and play games and kind of eat our meals down there.
See, I'm about 10 years older than you, so the first computer I encountered was, like Bill Gates, a timeshare terminal, also in a closet, because it was so noisy you had to put it at the middle school I went to in Rhode Island. This was probably 67 or 68. And I had no interest in that. It was timeshare, it was teletype, it was loud, it was noisy, and mostly
the games were very primitive. There were games like Hunt the Wumpus, but they were very primitive. It wasn't until the graphics computers came out, and it was around about 77, 78, I think it was an Atari 400 was my first one.
I got one of those eventually. Yeah.
Because the Atari 2600, the game console, was really popular. And so I said, well, that's cool, but I want more. I want to do more. So they got the 400 and the 800. And like you, it was the graphics. It was moving a sprite around, writing your first basic programs, typing them in from compute and magazines like that. Yeah.
I'm working on a story on BASIC because I think a lot of people have memories about it.
BASIC is huge. BASIC is huge. That and the first BASICs were written before Bill Gates. He gets the credit for it, of course, IBM BASIC, PC BASIC, but there were BASICs prior to that.
It started at Dartmouth,
right?
Basically as a way to teach people about computers, people who were not math majors.
BASIC was it Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code, I think is what it stands for.
Very good. I think that's it.
I don't know. There was some little pocket of the brain that was stored in. But it was designed to be a teaching language, a Fortran-like
Right, it was sort of like Fortran,
yeah,
but easier.
Yeah, and thank goodness for BASIC, although I think you and I and our generation learned how to program the worst possible way with GoSub, GoTo.
They say that once you learn BASIC, you're ruined. You can't learn anything else.
Ruined for life. So you got into it. It was fun for you. Did you think it would be a professional career?
I sort of dabbled in writing things. There was a book of BASIC adventure games, which had a game I wrote, which I think I got $40 or something for.
Oh, that's neat. So one of your first things was an adventure game.
Yeah, I wrote an adventure game.
Do you remember much of the storyline?
It was set in the Arctic, and I knew nothing about the Arctic. I actually also wrote a program which I uploaded to a BBS at the time and then forgot about. And a couple of weeks ago, there's this guy who... named Ira Goldklang, who has an amazing repository of TRS-80 stuff. And I found he had this program I uploaded to a BBS, and I don't have a TRS-80 anymore, but I do have a TRS-80 emulator for my Mac. And I was reacquainted with my slot machine game, which I wrote knowing nothing about slot machines.
Knowing how to write the code was more important than knowing what you were coding about.
I basically did the animation of the reels cycling on my TRS-80. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I wrote a few games, and I thought, maybe I could make a lot of money at it, but I did not.
Well, you know, that was a good time to get into computing. And how did you start writing about computers?
Well, there was a magazine called Creative Computing, which I loved.
I remember. I loved that. Who was the... Was it David Bunnell? Who was it?
David Ahl.
David Ahl, that's right.
The creative computing guy. Dave Bunnell started PC Magazine and PC World and Mac World and Personal Computing and several others. And... Yeah, I was reading Byte and Creative Computing and a bunch of others.
Creative Computing was fun because it was more focused at a fun user instead of business.
It was a great magazine. I sent them a review, I think, of some games.
You were 16?
I was, I guess, maybe 18, 17.
Yeah.
And I basically and I probably did on a typewriter at the time or maybe on the TRS-80, but I reviewed a few games and sent it in. And they sent me like $60 or something like that.
And and the game reviews are short. They were just like little paragraphs. They would have 10 of them on a page.
Right. I think they combined my four reviews with six or seven others by other people.
Right.
And I did a couple of things for them, and then I sort of segued into doing movie reviews for a while.
What part of the country were you living in?
Boston.
Boston.
My father taught at BU.
Oh, neat. What did he teach?
He actually started teaching at BU, and then he segued into being an administrator, and he worked in the president's office. For 30 years?
Yeah, I was lucky because I was getting into this in Silicon Valley. I was working as a disc jockey in San Jose in the late 70s and early 80s. So there was this kind of, I don't know how it was in Boston, I guess because of MIT and all the colleges, there probably was some stuff going on.
Well, Boston had the Boston Computer Society.
BCS, that's right.
Which was sort of amazing because...
There were two big user groups. There was Homebrew Computer Club, but then there was the Berkeley Macintosh Users Group, BCS, the Boston Computer Society. These were huge.
It was thousands of people at a meeting. And basically, anytime anything new came out, like the Macintosh, the East Coast premiere would be at the BCS meeting. So Steve Jobs would come and demo the Mac to the membership.
Right.
Unfortunately, I did not attend that month.
you missed the big meeting.
But I did go to a bunch of other ones of new Apple products. I think I saw the Apple III. And
people forget how important in the early days users groups were. It was really when you got together. Most computer people were kind of loners anyway. But that one time a month, you would all gather together in a big auditorium. And there was always kind of a standard program. I don't know how BCS was. Did it start with questions?
I think there was some Q&A, and you'd kind of mill about and talk to other folks.
Right. There was a disc librarian who would have a bunch of discs in the back.
I eventually got my Amiga discs.
Right.
I think at the Amiga subsection of the BCS. Right.
Amiga SIG. Then at least at BMUG, there was a Q&A thing where you would stand up and say, I'm trying to find a way to hook up a daisy wheel printer to a TRS-80, but I don't know what kind of serial interface.
Right.
And then there's always these hardcore geeks in there say, well, what you need? And there was this great give and take. And then they'd have a raffle, right? They'd get software from the different companies.
Yeah, I think there were some giveaways.
Yeah, there was giveaways. I'm trying to remember. I just remember these big boxes of software. In those days, they were giant boxes of software. And they'd give that away. And then you'd have a speaker from the industry who'd come up and talk about it. It might be Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Who else did you see? Do you remember anything?
I remember seeing the VIC-20.
Commodore.
Sort of the predecessor of the Commodore 64.
Yeah.
Several different iterations of the TRS-80. Atari stuff.
Now, you're younger than Paul Thurrott. Did you see Paul Thurrott wandering around in any of these BCS meetings? I don't know if he was a BCS member.
I wonder whether he was there.
I wonder. That's an interesting
All sorts of interesting people were there. The first one I went to was the demo of VisiCalc. And I think maybe it was the first public demonstration of the first spreadsheet.
Wow. And VisiCalc was Dan
Bricklin and Bob Frankston.
And Bob Frankston, who are still actually
they're
around
still
and
around
part
and,
of the community.
Yeah, they're still doing cool stuff.
Yeah, Bricklin and Frankston. So they came and they demoed it?
They demoed it. And even though I was like a guy, like I was entering high school and not particularly interested in math, I think I did sort of, I was smart enough to understand it was a big deal.
Huge.
They would type in numbers and there would automatically be a total at the bottom.
Auto recalculate. You change one number, the number at the bottom changes. That was huge, and they and it was the first killer app. I think. I mean,
yes.
By which I mean, in this, I don't know if this phrase still exists, but it was an application so important that you would buy a computer just to run the application.
There is one earlier candidate for the first killer app, and that would be the Electric Pencil, which was sort of the first microcomputer word processor.
Right.
But VisiCalc, I mean, actual real companies went out and bought
Apple
computers.
IIs just to run VisiCalc.
And it was a big deal for the Apple II because at first it ran only on the Apple II.
Right. Yeah, that was the killer app. There's no killer apps anymore, are there?
And, you know, the web is the killer app these days. So
your
browser is the closest thing you have to a killer app.
Right.
I think there are killer apps for tablets and phones to some extent.
There might be. You might buy an iPhone in the early days because only Instagram was only on iPhones. You might say, well, I'm going to buy an iPhone because I want to use Instagram. For instance, but now everything's on everything pretty much. So, all right. So you went to college. Did you study computer science or writing?
Well, I took one class on Pascal and failed it. And
it's different at that level, isn't it?
Yeah. And because I was so good at BASIC, I couldn't even understand Pascal.
Right.
So I majored in history.
Smart man. That's what I majored in.
And I minored in English. I figured history is a good background for almost anything.
Sure.
Which turned out to be true.
Yeah. And where'd you go to school?
Boston University.
BU. All right. But so when did it start becoming a career for you instead of just a hobby?
Well, I was sort of dabbling in freelance writing. I would do movie reviews. I wrote for a magazine called Cine Fantastique, which was a slick magazine about adventure movies and science fiction and horror. And so I would do
movie reviews. Kind of a geek? It was the geeky movies that you would cover?
To some extent. Actually, after a while, I would review whatever they asked me to. And they would ask me to review horror movies, which I actually had no interest in, but it was still fun to review them. So I was doing that. I was and am still interested in cartoons and animation. And a friend of mine started an animation fanzine, and I started helping him with that. And I took over more of that and got into desktop publishing.
Ah, so you got an Apple Macintosh in the early days and a LaserWriter.
LaserWriter and PageMaker. I used PageMaker when it had a limit of 16 pages per publication. And if you wanted to do something bigger than 16 pages, you had to do it in separate files.
Oh, yeah.
So I was doing that, and this was when I was going to college. And so basically almost all of my spare time was devoted to writing and publishing stuff.
Right.
And
right.
If I had been a little bit younger, I would have been doing this all on the web, but instead we did it on paper.
And that was a huge shift. It really was. But in the 80s, there was no web. You had modems, you had BBSs. That was the closest thing.
I was on CompuServe and
CompuServe,
and
Genie. Okay, this is a question. This is how you could tell if somebody's an old timer. Do you remember your CompuServe number?
I want to say it was 74352, 3114.
That's very good.
That's close.
I was 75106, 3134. It's fine, and you're right. You start to forget it, but you remember the format. It begins with a 7. It's got a comma. That's pretty good. That's impressive. Wait, did you use MCI mail? That was the earliest email I encountered.
I was never on MCI mail, but the first computer magazine I worked for, I believe at the start, we had like one email address for the entire publication, which was an MCI number.
Yeah.
And like once an hour, we had a Mac, which once an hour would dial out on the dial-up and ping MCI mail and bring in our email.
Look at all these. Curtis B is 71310, 1271, Web 5197, 74001, 3646. And you could tell how long they were on CompuServe because the lower the 7,000 number.
Was there somebody who was like 0001, 0001?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think all began with 7. CompuServe, I'm trying to remember, was CompuServe, it was, I think, H&R Block that had leftover computer time, because during the day they were calculating tax returns like crazy and nobody was using them at night. They said, boy, there might be a business in kind of renting out computer time at night. And it actually, I think it was my first experience online.
And it was relatively cheap, although by today's standards it was really expensive. It was like...
Because they charged you by the hour.
It wasn't like $15 an hour
or something
like that?
Yeah, they charged you by the hour. And I remember I had a 300 baud couple phone modem that was a coupler.
Mm-hmm.
So you would... I bet people today, they go, what the hell?
You
would dial the number on the phone, and you probably had a dial.
Right. You listen for the squeal.
You go, and then you'd quickly jam it on the coupler, which was an acoustic seal. It had rubber cups. And it would then do the training, and you'd lucky if you could get it to work, 300 baud.
300 baud, so you could read more quickly than the text came in.
Oh, yeah. And so you'd be, there you go, there's an acoustic coupler. That was a fancier one than I had. That's a pretty fancy one. And then, of course, the text would come across the screen. It was text, not graphics. And it would say, I can't remember, login, probably, colon. And you'd type 75106, 3135. And then password, type that. And then you'd wait, it'd think. And you could see it thinking. And then it would scroll up, welcome to CompuServe. And there was a kind of a text-based menu that you'd select an item from.
There was news and...
I played Colossal Cave, speaking of adventure games. So it had one of the early adventure games, which originally was Crowther and Wood's Dungeon, whatever it was called. And they had it on CompuServe. It was an extended one, a 451.1. And fortunately, I borrowed a friend's account. He was at Atari, so he had a comp account for CompuServe. Thank you, Owen, because I spent about 800 hours playing Colossal Cave on my 300-baud modem. And if I'd had to pay for that, I'd probably be in prison.
There was the CB simulator. Wasn't that like a chat room or something?
Yes. That was the early chat room,
and
right?
And it was like, you know, calling it the CB simulator made sense at the time.
Yeah, because, I get it. They'll talk and then I'll talk.
It's like a CB.
And I think we might have even used CB jargon in there a little bit.
Well, that's where you got the idea of like handles. And
handles. That's right. Do you think that chat handles come from CB?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I never thought about that. Wow. All right. So we're going to take a break. We're talking to Harry McCracken. We're now going to get into the era of your first magazine, your first computer magazine. What was the name of it?
I worked at a magazine called Computer Buying World, which was a big flop, but fun.
Computer Buying World. Was it the predecessor to, what was that big Ziff Davis Shopper?
We thought we were going to kill Computer Shopper, which we failed to do.
Nothing killed Computer Shopper except life.
Yeah.
Then that killed it pretty good. We'll talk about that in a second. But first, let's talk about mailing things. You wouldn't think that would be an interesting topic, but it is if you're in a business where you have to do it. And I'm not talking about 100 Christmas cards, kids. I'm talking about invoices, mailers. I'm talking about packages. I'm talking about somebody who sells stuff on PayPal or eBay. Maybe you're on Etsy. And you've already dealt with this thing. You got to buy bubble pack. You got to package them up. You got to guess. You lick some stamps, put it on the front, type out a mailing label. You got to bring it to the post office. And then you know what happens? You get there, and there's 1,000 people in front of you mailing their Christmas cards. And they've never been to the – it's like they never have been to the post office. They don't know how it works. You get in line over there. What? Where do I go? You get in line over. I've got to. No, this is not for you. December is the wrong month to be doing mailing at the post office. This is the month you need to try Stamps.com. This is the pro mailing solution for people who mail stuff for a living. I want you to go to Stamps.com and take a look at it. They let you print U.S. postage. You buy it and print it on your computer, on your printer. We've got a great USB scale for you, which is fantastic, that actually does the weighing and tells the computer. You don't have to enter anything in. In fact, you don't even have to enter. If you're Amazon, eBay, Etsy, PayPal seller, if you're using QuickBooks, if you've got an address book on your computer, you don't have to enter anything in. Stamps.com's smart. It'll actually pull that information out of your computer, print out the label, prints right on an envelope, including your logo, the return address and everything, and all the postage. Or you can print labels for packages, even international mail. Stamps.com is fantastic. Here is the USB scale, by the way. This is the kit you'll get. I just want to let you know what it's going to look like. So you go to Stamps.com, you sign up for the trial offer. One of the things they send you is this great USB scale. And by the way, you can cancel. The scale is yours to keep. It's kind of our gift to you from Stamps.com. So the scale is up to 25 pounds. It's USB. You just plug it right into the back of your computer, Mac or PC. And now you're mailing like a pro. So here's the deal. Go to Stamps.com. You probably, you know, low, $80. That's good. $25 free postage. That's good. I'll take that. No. Click the microphone above that, which says, heard us on a podcast. Enter in before you buy. All one word. Not triangulation. Oh, yeah. Do triangulation. That's the name of this show. Triangulation. Thank you. I'm glad somebody's paying attention. You enter in the name of your favorite show, in this case, Triangulation. And look at that. That $80 offer, suddenly you get an old man on there saying, hey, I got a $110 offer for you. $55 in free postage, a free digital scale, $5 supply kit, and a four-week trial just for using our offer code Triangulation. How about that, huh? How about that? Triangulation. That's the show, right?
Yes.
All right. We thank Stamps.com for their support. Really is great if you do any mailing. This is the way to do it. We do it. We got two scales. Stamps.com. Harry McCracken is our guest. He's the technologizer. Now at Time Magazine, which is kind of cool. I want to talk about that saga. So what was it? Computer shopping?
A computer buying world.
Computer buying world.
The notion was the computer shopper was kind of for consumers. Computer buying world would be aimed at businesses.
Sure, that makes sense.
Instead of buying one PC, they'd buy 100, which would be very appealing to advertisers.
And now who was doing that? What was the company?
It was part of IDG. Published and still publishes PC World and
right.
Mac World.
Right.
And Computer Shopper at the time was literally 1,000 pages, mostly advertising, because if there were hundreds of PC companies.
It was amazing. You could make furniture out of a year's subscription.
Yeah, it was amazing. And this was before the web, so if you wanted to advertise
that's where you went.
Computers, you did it in Computer Shopper.
There were two big companies. I mean, there were some small ones, but it was IDG was one, Ziff Davis was the other, and these were the giants in technology publishing. And so, of course, if Ziff Davis had PC Magazine, you had to have PC World.
Right.
If Ziff Davis had Computer Shopper, you had to have Computer Buying World.
They had Mac User. We had Mac World.
Mac World. You had to. It was head-to-head. And I remember going to the Comdex, and it was... You go, hello, McCracken. Yes, because I was on the Ziff Davis team. You know, we practically had jerseys and helmets. It really was, wasn't it?
We called Ziff Davis the evil empire.
Yeah, well, I don't remember what we called you, but I didn't. But it wasn't nice.
It seemed like Ziff Davis people maintained that IDG was not worth paying attention to.
We don't even because maybe it was just my perception as a Ziff Davis guy, and this was in the early 90s where it was starting to go down. It was all starting to fall apart. But my impression, I actually liked the IDG guys a lot. I was a little worried about Ziff Davis. And in fact, I was right to be worried. IDG has survived. Ziff Davis is kind of
IDG still exists
off.
And is doing okay.
Yeah.
And Ziff Davis also still exists, but is much, much, much smaller.
So after Computer Buying World, CBW
CBW... lasted for, I guess, a couple of years.
And what
maybe.
Were you writing for that?
I was like the reviews editor. So I was in charge of the reviews section.
You stole those out to the freelancers.
We were reviewing things like 286 laptops and new versions of WordPerfect and that kind of stuff.
Did you have a lab, a place that you could review these kind of? Or
we had a lab, but it was like a room, which I would go into.
Ziff Davis, and this was nuts, built a facility, a testing facility, its own building in Silicon Valley, in Foster City. I think Bill McCrone was the guy who designed that and oversaw that. And that was a boondoggle.
We were like a small operation.
That was a real boondoggle.
There were maybe like five editors, and I did the reviews and the tech stuff.
Was it as thick as Computer Shopper?
No, it was at the end like 10% as big as Computer Shopper.
That's when I knew computer publishing was dead, was when I saw Computer Shopper in its final stage. Because that was literally, it was a tabloid-sized magazine that was usually about 3 or 4 inches thick. And it went down to nothing, a quarter of an inch. And that's when I knew it was all over for computer magazines. The internet had destroyed that business. So after CBW, where'd you go?
So for a while, I freelanced. We shared office space for a while with the PC World folks. And PC World published something which also sounds like something out of the past. So they had a special edition called PC World Lotus Edition.
all about Lotus Notes.
Which was all about 123, OmniPro.
OmniPro, the word processor. You know, I loved OmniPro.
Yeah, it was great.
That was the best word processor I ever used.
This was at a time when Lotus, which just recently IBM killed the Lotus name, but back in the 90s, Lotus was big. And we published a special edition of PC World with Lotus, and I knew the guy who was in charge of it, and he called me in, and he said, you know, I think probably PC World Lotus Edition is not going to be around for that much longer. It was based on a contract with Lotus.
You mean it wasn't just a 1 month special?
It was
a magazine.
It was your copy of PC World with really well done extra pages all about Lotus.
Interesting.
And he said, we have this contract renewal coming up, and I think they probably won't renew.
Yeah.
But we do have this job, and I thought of you. And I took the job mainly because it sounded like the Lotus Edition wouldn't continue forever. I figured I didn't want to do Lotus forever, but it might be a foot in the door at PC World. And so I stopped freelancing and took that job.
There's a certain symmetry to this because Lotus 123 took over from VisiCalc, which we were talking about. That was Mitch Kapor's IBM PC version of the dominant app of the 70s and 80s. VisiCalc was the spreadsheet, which was later eclipsed by Excel from Microsoft, of course.
So, yeah, and because Excel was overtaking 123, the idea of a PC World Lotus Edition was somewhat shaky.
Yeah. What did they give you at PC World? What'd you do there?
So my boss was right. PC World Lotus Edition only lasted for a few months.
You jumped off that lily pad.
But this was at a time when computer magazines were still doing really, really well.
Yeah.
This was the era of Windows 95.
Oh, yeah.
And when people were first getting on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
And so
accounts, baby.
So PC World was doing really well, and there was this big rivalry with PC Magazine. And PC Magazine was known for having a great reviews section with all the serious lab stuff. And PC World wanted to have a good...
We do the printer roundups. You'd review 800 printers.
Totally.
I mean, it was an amazing thing. Jim Louderback worked there. Of course, he later worked at Tech TV, and he was part of the labs. Bill McCrone was part of the labs. That was a big thing. So IDG said, we got to do that.
We need more reviews editors, and I became a reviews editor at PC World. I was still in Boston, by the way, at this point.
Is that where IDG was based?
IDG is headquartered in Boston, but PC World was in San Francisco.
Ended up moving there, yeah.
But we also had a Boston office, which I worked out of.
Right. Ziff Davis was in New York City. They had a place on Park Avenue. It was one Park Avenue, but we all called it one Dark Avenue because it was the oldest, coldest, horrible building near the Pan Am building, which arched over Park Avenue. It may have been even part of that. I can't remember. So I'm okay. You're in Boston. Did you eventually move out to San Francisco?
I did. I liked Boston, and they kept suggesting I move to San Francisco, and I would come out a lot. And finally, in 2002, I had a boss who begged and pleaded. And
2002? Oh, my God.
Years later.
The internet's already been born.
Well, I figured if this publishing thing doesn't work out, Boston will probably still be there.
Right.
And so I did move out, and now I don't want to leave.
It's great here. Yeah. We're talking to Harry McCracken, former editor of PC World, who is now on his own, except he's not, because Time Magazine now is getting into technology. I want to ask you what your dominant memory of the 90s was and what you feel like the big trends of the 90s were. I'd like to talk a little more. I like the reminiscing stuff. Getting old, we got a nice fire going in the fireplace here. That sparked up a little bit there. Might need to poke that a little bit later on. But first, you see Harry, he's looking at that. Look at the monitor.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's burning.
Even better.
How did they do that? I don't ever want to give this up. I love this. We used to mock. There was a sales guy. Don't stick your hand in the fire. You could get burned. There was a sales guy. He was. See, there you go. That's the experimenter. That's the scientist. Well, what happens if I
gave it away?
Yeah. No, that's good. There was a guy. There was a sales guy we used to mock at Ziff Davis, who had a faux fireplace in his office. It was one of those things you just bump up against the wall and it looks like it's burning. It looks just like this. And he was so proud of it. He invited people and said, "Look, sit by the fire."
So what were you doing? Was this like pre-ZDTV?
Yeah. I'll tell you my story. Yeah, because that's a checkered story. But first, a word from Ford. Ford Motor Company, my favorite. You know, the Mustang is going to be handed down, and the Ford Fusion is coming along. And it's because I want the latest, greatest toys. Now, I was really thrilled in 2010 when I got the Mustang, the Ford Sync, and I could talk to the car. Remember, I used to go on and on about Sync and how to play my music, and I could talk to it. Well, they have moved on. This thing is now a consumer electronic playground in the new Fords. Things like this, the Bliss Blind Spot Information System. You've got... One of the things they're doing with the cars, they really see these as a platform. They know that technology is going to change. And so what they do is they load these things up with sensors. They basically see it as a platform. They use the sensors as needed, but they also give an API, and so they're getting developers to write apps for the cars. So two of the sensors are radared. They've got radar all over the thing, radar. It's amazing. As this stuff gets cheaper and cheaper, they can incorporate it into your fender. You've got radar in your fender on the rear side of the car, the left and the right, that's watching the blind spot, you know, the part you can't see with the side mirrors. And when there's a car in that blind spot, you get a little light on the mirror that shows you there's a car there and a little audible tone. They also use it as you're parking out, so it helps you with the pulling out of parking spaces. If you can't see around the cars, which happens all the time to me, it will warn you there's oncoming traffic. You can actually see a signal that there's oncoming traffic. You got radar in the rear of your car. That's like the camera in the front that keeps you in the lane. It's like the intelligence that gives you auto park assist. This is wild. They must be using radar also in the front and the back here, because you press a button, you're driving along, says, okay, I see a parking space. It literally on the screen, it says, pull forward. You pull forward, you stop. It says, okay, I got it from here. Bzzz, the wheel goes, the steering wheel, zzzz, in 24 seconds. This is the Bliss here. So this is the on the video, if you're watching the video, they've got the blind spot information system. The park assist, in 24 seconds, the steering wheel goes, zzzz, and it parks you in less than 24 seconds, parallel, perfectly. Much better than I could do. You know how you learn all the rules? You see watch this. The car, this is a, I think it's an Edge or an Escape. It's available in the 2013 Ford Taurus or the 2013 Fusion. That's my next car. The car literally does this. And the first time I got in a car with Park Assist, I was a little freaked out because it's like driving itself. But it does it perfectly. It's a little autonomous vehicle for at least that few seconds. I'll tell you what, I cannot wait to get the state-of-the-art Ford vehicle. I want you to take a look. You can go to Ford.com/technology or go to a Ford dealer near you and test drive the 2013 Fusion or the 2013 Taurus, and give a try to the Park Assist. It's so cool. We are talking to Harry McCracken, good friend for many years. He's been on Twit many times. Is one of the most astute people covering technology. Things have changed so much. The internet, you've mentioned a couple of times. That really was the watershed, wasn't it? In the mid '90s.
Yeah, I mean, I always think back to the fact that the two best-selling issues of PC World of all time were both 1995. One of them was a cover story called How to Connect to the Internet, which at the time you still needed someone to explain to you how to do.
Because you'd have a slip account, you have to turn it into a PPP account, and there were these little programs you'd run.
It was kind of complicated.
It was crazy.
And the other one was Windows 95, which was also a huge deal.
So, you know, in some ways, 95 was the beginning of a big change in technology.
There was certainly kind of the era where Microsoft became totally dominant as well.
Well, I remember Steve Jobs saying that. He said we had a 10-year lead on Microsoft. In 1984, when we came out with the Mac, we had a 10-year lead, and we frittered it away And when he says we, he means people like Gil Emilio and Michael Spinner, the guy, John Scully, the guys who fired him. They frittered it away. And he says by 1995, Microsoft had not only caught up, was leapfrogging us. And that's true. Windows 95 was, we forget now, but it was good.
And it was way better than Windows 3.1.
It was horrible. But it still, it wasn't quite NT. It still, you could crash the whole operating system with a program crash. And with those new browsers, that happened a lot.
Yeah, you still needed to manage your memory a little bit by hand.
Yeah, there was a whole market in memory managers.
QEMM.
Yeah. Wow, I forgot all about that. Those were bad old days.
Yeah, so those are the two things that pop into mind, kind of the web and Microsoft's dominance.
Did you know in 95, I mean, that the internet would disintermediate and would be bad for magazines?
No, because it took surprisingly long.
There was this sense of ruling the world. I remember with Ziff Davis, with PC Magazine particularly, which I did not work for, but they were the masters of the universe at that time. You know, they'd go to Comdex, which also went away, and they were gods. They had unlimited expense accounts. They could see anybody, talk to anybody. They'd dance with Bill Gates.
I mean, PC World was very successful, and it came out once a month. PC Magazine was even more successful and came out twice a month.
Twice a month.
And continued to do very well for really a long time after the web was around.
So it was in 91 or 92 that they thought we should be into TV. They really didn't get this internet thing very well. They thought that TV was going to be the next big thing. And they decided to do a TV arm, and they put Bill McCrone, who was the editor-in-chief of PC Magazine, had started the PC Mag Labs, which eventually became Ziff Davis Labs. So he was, you know, he was like their heavy hitter, in charge of a television division. They went out and they got a guy named Gary Kay, who's a very good television producer, ended up working for CNN and a lot of other companies, as a consultant. He was the TV guy, and was McCrone and Gary Kay were looking for people to help him build a TV presence. And I don't know how I got an appointment with them, but I went and I met with them in 1992, and they said, good, we got a job for you. Gina Smith and Jim Latterback, two Ziff Davis heavy hitters, were doing a TV show. They launched in 94, out of the old Apple TV in Cupertino, called The Personal Computing Show. There's a good name. And they were in front of a green screen. They had taken pictures of a very nice office, and they just shot an hour and a half of the office with birds. And then that was supposed to be where they were. And I came in as a consultant and eventually ended up hosting the show with Gina. We did one season, that's all. And the plan, which is a very weird plan, and this came from their computer shopper days, was they were going to do editorial and they were going to do shopping. And that would pay for the editorial. So we would do a half hour of editorial and then a half hour of completely, you know, advertising shopping, like Home Shopping Network for computers. And that was going to be the computer shopper show. And that, so they were buying time on CNBC and all these stations to put the editorial half hour and then the shopping half hour. But the shopping flopped, so the editorial had to go away. They couldn't afford to do that. And that was how Ziff Davis Television started. I stayed with them, Gina and I stayed with them developing shows through 96 when we paired up with MSNBC and did the site. So Ziff Davis thought TV was going to be the next big thing, even as the internet started to take over.
And so did CNET. I mean, CNET was originally more of a TV company than a...
Yeah, I worked for Halsey in the earliest days in 91. That was before Ziff Davis. We did a pilot, Fred Davis and I and John C. Dvorak and Gina. We did a roundtable show that was horrible. And I think at that point, CNET said, you know, we'll do the web first. They were smart. See, that was the difference. CNET said, we think it's going to happen on the web. We'll do TV to support the web, but the web is where it's going to happen. And that was as it turned out, a very good move for them.
Do you remember Ziff Davis Interchange by any chance?
What was that? That sounds familiar.
It was a beautifully done online service which Ziff Davis put together.
A silo, like AOL? And
it was sort of like a really well-done AOL, but they were going to launch it around like early 95, so the timing didn't work out.
Did IDG have things like that they were looking at?
You know, the thing about IDG was it was always very decentralized, and the decisions didn't come from the top.
Right.
Essentially, PC world would be competing with InfoWorld and Macworld and the other guys. And
it's kind of like Microsoft today, where the divisions compete with each other.
IDG would publish other magazines, which sort of competed with PC World, and everybody sort of had their own online strategies. And so there was no one place, and the folks at the top didn't tell anybody what to do.
Ziff was family-run, so it was a little bit different. It was really a dictatorship. Bill Ziff and his sons ran that place. And Bill Ziff was an interesting fellow because he had run, like, sailing magazines. They were specialty magazines, not computer magazines. Sold those all, got into the computer magazine business, and then very wisely got out of it in the nick of time and sold it to Forceman Little, which was a holding company. And it's been downhill ever since. Actually, maybe it was SoftBank before Forceman.
IDG was founded by Pat McGovern.
Pat McGovern
in 1964.
He was a genius.
He's still there, but he very early on decided he didn't want to tell people what to do. He sort of almost acted more like a venture capitalist who would give money to startups.
He's kind of legendary. He's still around.
Yeah.
What's he doing these days?
He's still the chairman of IDG.
And they do conferences mostly now. They still have Macworld magazine.
There's still Macworld and PC World and Computer World.
PC World is still in print?
PC World still exists
in
print.
In paper?
So does Macworld.
I know Macworld does, yeah.
And IDG also, it has magazines all over the world, which was kind of a difference between it and Ziff Davis.
Right.
Ziff Davis would tend to license.
Right. There's PC Mag Brazil, but it's not a Ziff Davis publication.
IDG owned a lot of them, and IDG got into China very early. And IDG started doing venture capital in places like China.
So as it turned out, Pat McGovern knew what he was doing.
He has had the last laugh.
You know who did also knew who he was doing is the guy who owned Comdex, Shelley Adelson.
Mm-hmm.
There was a smart fellow. He basically put together Comdex, a computer dealers expo. The idea was bring computer hardware manufacturers together with dealers at a yearly meeting in Vegas. It was huge, bigger than CES. At its peak was probably 300,000 people. It was huge. I can't remember what the largest was.
It was ginormous,
that was
before there was a huge convention center, so it took over the entire town.
The Sands, it would take over the convention, it would take over every bit of Las Vegas. You couldn't get a room in Las Vegas because it was Comdex week. And Shelley also very wisely got out of Comdex before it crashed. It eventually went away. He made a lot of money on that, then invested in casinos, not just in Vegas, but also in Macau, made billions of dollars. He's one of the richest men in the world. And it all started with the computer dealer expo, Comdex. So, PC World, why did you leave PC World? Because that's got to be a pretty gutsy thing to do. You're doing well there.
Well, essentially, I had been there for 13 years. And, the PC was great, but it was kind of clear that the PC was not going to dominate everything.
Really?
And as much as I would always explain to people that the PC was really important, and PC World was also about HGTV and phones and cameras. When you have a PC in your name, it does tend to define you. And it also occurred to me, based partially on looking at what people like you were doing, that a journalist didn't necessarily need a large company anymore.
Right.
And thanks to the web, a one-man show could have access to the same tools and publishing platforms that large companies had. Without all the bureaucracy and so forth. And PC World had existed before I got there and did fine. I knew it would do well without me. And I thought the most exciting single thing I could do would be to try to create something from scratch.
You know, it was right about then that PC Magazine gave up printing editions.
Yeah, that happened like a few months after.
Online. Did that feel like a victory? Like we're the last man standing?
Well, I've sort of been through that twice just because Newsweek, which competed with Time for 70
They've gone away,
years,
too. They've announced that after January, they're no longer publishing a print version. Yeah.
I think in both cases, the competition had moved past the competition between those two arch rivals anyhow.
And you kind of don't want to see these guys struggle and fail because they're in the same business.
You'd much rather be the stronger publication in a field so successful it has at least two strong publications.
Exactly. That's what, I keep wondering when somebody's going to do what we're doing. It's really lonely out here. So, please be my guest. That's a good point. Newsweek kind of crumbled in the last year as well. So how did it go at first? Was Technologizer an instant hit? How did that work for you? Were you able to get advertising?
Well, I basically thought about it at work for a while and then decided to do it.
It's very brave. I'm sure there are a lot of people watching who are saying, I'd like to do that in my business. What do you need to do? Did you save up a lot of money?
Not really. I mean, actually, I bought a house right before I quit my job.
That's smart.
I figured it would be easier to get a mortgage when I'd been at the same job for 13 years. So I bought my house and then quit. And in terms of advertising, I partnered up with a company called Federated Media.
Yeah.
Which does ads.
John Battelle's company.
Yeah.
Now, he's another old-timer in the PC magazine business.
He was at Wired, and he started the Industry Standard, which was another magazine that got to be very fat.
Who said, the future's on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And he started one of the first web banner ad selling companies. But he was smart. He picked very high quality, only a handful of very high quality blogs to work with. So you got to work with him is a pretty high testament.
Yeah, which was great and really helped me get going.
By the way, they're struggling now too.
They're in a changing world.
Yeah, it's amazing because what used to take 10 years, actually probably used to take 100 years, then took 50 years, 40 years, 10 years. Now a couple of years, and it's the business world. Everything's changing so rapidly. You can't build a business on a single business plan. I don't know what the answer is, but things are changing so rapidly. So Federated Media, that gave you instant income.
It helped right away, and it gave me some credibility.
Yep.
And I kind of felt that on the web, all content is equal access to the web. And if something is worth reading, it'll do well if it's at a big site. It can also do well if it's at a small site. And that did sort of turn out to be true because I very quickly got around 400,000 readers.
Wow.
When I started the site.
That's a huge number.
At the very start, I thought, I want to be the next TechCrunch, and I want to hire a whole bunch of people and become huge. But literally 6 weeks after I started the site, basically the economy collapsed, and especially the media economy collapsed. And so I very quickly switched to a new business model, which was not to get big, but to stay really small and be the most important site I could be while small. And I found I could get 400,000 readers based on my content and content by a few good freelance contributors.
It's hit-driven, though, isn't it? Because I remember that there were, and it's still to this day, Harry McCracken's got the article of the week. It's like the one everybody has to read. And there were, and you had a few of those in a row where you, I can't remember. Give me a couple of them because you obviously will remember.
Well, the most successful story I did was called The 13 Greatest Error Messages of All Time, which people are still reading to this day.
Right. Those things live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That got like a million page views and huge numbers of people talking about it.
Did you quickly realize
500 comments?
This is how it's going to have to work, is that I'm going to have to find that article that's going to go viral.
I knew already because at PCWorld.com, we began to do that even before I left.
Is there a formula? A number is good, right? A list?
Well, there are all kinds of formulas like lists and so forth, but it's also possible to do crappy lists that nobody wants to read.
and that's what happened to Dig.
I feel very strongly.
It became the list aggregator, right?
You've got to believe in your own content. On the web, if you do something you don't believe in, people can tell.
Yep.
And so I tended to do stories that got me excited.
You can't be cynical about it and say, okay, I'm going to craft a hit article.
You can. And you can, for a while, you can succeed by being cynical. But I feel like long term, you'll do better if you're sincerely excited by your content. And when I thought about the idea of doing a list of the best error messages, like the blue screen of death and the sad Mac, I got excited by that. And so I put just as much effort into that as I would have if I had been doing something more serious.
I remember that one very well. That was a great article.
And then my readers started sending in their own favorite error messages I didn't mention. And so I did the 13 other greatest error messages of all time, which was all reader-submitted stuff.
Awesome. You in after the fact, you go, oh, that's obvious. But it isn't obvious until you do it. Then it's obvious, right?
And very quickly you know. In the old world of computer magazines, if you were lucky, several weeks or months after you put out a magazine, you would hear how well it sold.
Right.
And PC World did reader surveys, so we had an idea of what people were reading. On the web, you know, literally sometimes within 10 minutes,
you know. You see how many retweets, how many shares, how many likes. You could tell immediately.
If it's on TechMeme, if Google News picks it up.
I remember Ziff Davis they do a lot of focus groups to see which were the most read articles within an issue. Because it's not enough to know that issue sold well. You're trying to find out, well, where are people reading?
We did that every month, and it was extremely expensive, and it took many weeks before we got any data.
And probably not accurate, right? I mean, how accurate is it going to be?
It gave you a general ballpark, but the issue with focus groups and surveys is...
They tell you what you want to hear.
And the people who do them or people who have enough time to do them.
Yeah, they're not the audience you want either.
PC World was for busy professionals, and busy professionals don't do surveys.
Don't do surveys, yeah. So what were there any surprises, articles that you thought, oh, nobody's going to be interested in this, that took off?
Every once in a while there would be something that would just pick up. When Google came out with Chrome, I think Google discontinued the Google Toolbar or something like that.
Yeah.
And there were all immense numbers of people who loved the Google Toolbar. And I did just a very short item on the Google Toolbar, which for a while, if you searched on Google for Google Toolbar, my story would show up.
That's what you want.
And it was not that big a story, but I had this huge influx of people.
Right.
And so I started doing more stories about the Google Toolbar and more ambitious stories about the Google Toolbar because I learned there was an audience for them.
It really is different. You get immediate feedback like that. You can tune what you're doing. Now, the problem is, and I really see this also happening, is you become driven by it.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it's all about link bait. It's all about how do I get that? It's almost an addiction. How do I get that again? I want to do that again. And what happens, and I see this a lot with blogs, and it's really been the detriment of journalism, not just tech journalism, but especially tech journalism, is that people are writing sensationalistic stories, sensationalistic headlines. They don't really care. The Instagram story was a very good example of people kind of intentionally blowing it up almost. CNET wrote an article, Instagram wants to sell your pictures, which is clearly wasn't what the story was, but I bet it got a lot more links than Nilay Patel saying, nah, it's not that bad.
I bet Nilay's story did well, too, because A, it was really smart.
Yeah.
And B, there were hundreds of sites doing stories about Instagram wanting to sell your pictures.
Right.
And Nilay, he was taking a different stance, and he was smart about it, and that stands out.
That's good news. So smart can still win.
Basically, almost always the stories I've done that I'm most proud of are also the ones that do the best.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're a really good example of that. Did time come to you? How did that happen?
Well, so I did Technologizer for a while, and I was having a great time and having fun. And I started talking to Time, and while I enjoyed having my own site, I realized there was value in being associated with larger brands, too.
Right.
And I grew up on Time. I mean, Time is one of the things.
Yeah, we were a Newsweek family. You were one of the other, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a great affinity for Time growing up. And so I started doing a weekly Technologizer column for Time.com, and that turned out to be a lot of fun. And while I was having a really good time being on my own, I kind of felt like I had proven I could do it. And I loved Time, and I really enjoyed working with the Time folks, and they had fun with me. And so after about a year and a half of kind of doing Time on the side, we started talking about, you know, a more serious partnership.
Now, is Technologizer in the print edition of Time, or is it web only?
I write for the print edition, too. I do I do stuff all the time. I do some features for print. And
do you worry that being in print is kind of old school? That maybe when you see Newsweek stop its print edition, that maybe there isn't a future for print?
I certainly wouldn't want to do print entirely.
Only.
I mean, the web is, in a lot of ways, is way more fun, and it's seat of the pants, and if you have an idea on the web, just do it. And if it fails, that's okay because you move on.
Right.
With print, you want the ideas to be really good because you have a limited amount of space. And there are more people involved in print. Basically, I'm pitching the Time editors for stuff for print. But as part of what I do, it's a lot of fun. And that's part of why I came on board with Time. So Technologizer.com, if you go to now, you land at Time.com in a section which is just my stuff.
Did you sell it to them?
No. I'm essentially lending the Technologizer name to Time. My old content from before I started with Time still looks just the same. The new stuff is on Time.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an employee of Time.
It's good, though, because you have this in the back pocket always. And you want to keep that brand alive, right?
It's a brand that's served me well, and the Time folks were excited by it.
Good, good.
And I'm having a good time doing this. It's a little bit different, but fun.
It's really interesting to see people like you go the solo route. Brian Lamb did the same thing. And when he left Gizmodo, he started Wirecutter. I don't know if it seems like maybe there's a staff now, but initially it was just, this is what I think is the best stuff.
There was a good story on what he's doing in the New York Times by David Carr last week.
I think it's really interesting. I think that's one of the exciting things about the internet is that it is an opportunity for people to do something that you couldn't do before. You couldn't start a magazine by yourself.
I always say, like in the old days, when IDG decided to start Computer Buying World in 1991, I mean, they hired an editorial staff.
Millions.
A finance department, a sales staff, production people. They spent several months just getting ready to go. They had real estate. They paid some company a lot of money every month to print it. And on the web, almost all of those costs go away.
Right. Although I look at something like what SB Nation did with The Verge, which was a very long build, a long time. In some ways, that's the old model of the way they did The Verge. They really spent a lot of time designing it, thinking about it.
A lot closer, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's room for that as well. Obviously, The Verge is doing very well. But I'm glad to see that the solo entrepreneurs can also do that. We're talking to Harry McCracken, technologizer.com. Takes you to his section on his little corner of the time.com world. Our show today brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker, if you do presentations or podcasts, maybe you do you speak, you probably go through a lot of stock photos, stock videos, illustrations. Maybe if you're doing audio, you use music tracks and sound effects. Pond5 is the place to go. Look at this, 1.3 million video clips with 7,000 new ones this week, 8.2 million stock photos, 25,000 fresh ones this week. They've got illustrations. They've got music tracks, 1,500 new ones to the 80,000 track catalog, more than a quarter million sound effects, 2,600 After Effects projects. This is really a treasure trove for you. And I want you to try it out because they've got a great browser that makes it very easy to find what you're looking for. You can sample it all. So you know exactly what you're getting. And this is what we call royalty-free. You buy it once and use it as you need to. Lots of 1080p video, by the way. Stock footage from everywhere, all around the world, all sorts of topics. Go to Pond5 every week. They've got a new freebie, but I've got an even better deal for you. How about 50 free stock media files? All you have to do is go to pond5.com/triangulation, and you can download all 50. See, their thinking is, if you make an account at Pond5 and you see how the browser works, see how the download works, you'll be comfortable. You'll come back the next time you need stock media, which may not be for a while. They're giving you 50 sound effects, pictures, movies, After Effects. This is pretty incredible. Pond5.com/triangulation. I also want to talk to you folks who make these images and video. Pond5 is the best place to sell your business. They're shaking up the stock agency business with an open, artist-friendly marketplace. They give you the highest royalties in the business, 50% for every sale, and you set the pricing. So, in effect, you're saying exactly how much you're going to make. Great prices, but great selection. So, if you're a media maker or a media artist, Pond5.com. In fact, they told me that many of their customers are both. They both buy and sell. It really is a marketplace for content. Go there now, Pond, through the rest of the month. We only have a little bit longer. Pond5.com/triangulation. We thank them for their support of triangulation. Our guest is old friend Harry McCracken. You know, it's funny. I don't know if I ever ran into you in those heady days of Comdex and now CES. But obviously, we're parallel tracks all the way through.
I was certainly following your shows back then.
We were having fun. Doing television is very different than doing print, and it was very expensive and kind of probably not very practical. But Ziff Davis had the money, and they wanted to do it, so that's fine. Paul Allen eventually bought Tech TV, and he was losing so much. He lost $300 million. He was losing so much money, he sold it to Comcast. And now, by the way,
I saw the latest news.
It's G4, after 8 years struggling, trying to make a technology channel work, was mostly around gaming. Finally, they're thrown in the towel, and they've done a deal with Hearst's Esquire. They're going to become the Esquire channel. I have no idea what that means. But there's a lesson learned. Don't go in the cable television business. It's a terrible business.
I remember Pat McGovern, the founder of IDG.
Kept hearing rumors that IDG was going to do TV.
We did like one Computer World show.
Right.
And it was such a bad deal that he said, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake again.
He was smart. But I can tell you now, Ziff Davis was terrified that IDG, in fact, one of the reasons I think we rushed ZDTV was because they were really afraid IDG was going to do something. Everybody was sure IDG, Pat was going to, people were always trying to figure out what Pat was up to. He was going to do TV.
Yeah, he stayed out of TV after this one experiment.
A wise man. So let's talk, you know, 2013's coming. It's going to be an exciting year. We have seen huge changes in 2012. Mobile, location, the Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon stuff has been incredible. iPads taking off, phones, everything's getting smaller. What do you see as big trends for 2013? What are you looking ahead? What are you looking for? When you go to CES, what will you be looking for?
Well, part of the reason I'm having a good time doing what I'm doing is because this is the most fun time to write about technology since the 90s.
No, since ever. I can tell you right now, this is amazing what's happening.
And it's fun because it's so unpredictable.
Yeah.
If you had, back in 2006, if you had predicted the next 5 years, you would have totally botched it.
Yeah.
You would not have predicted most of the stuff that happened. And so I think the next 5 years are probably equally unpredictable. But, I mean, one of the most fun things recently has been the tablet wars. Until recently, they were a little bit depressing because you knew the iPad was doing well. And essentially all these other tablets came rushing into the battle and would immediately flop.
Mown down.
And at least now we are starting to see the beginnings of an actual tablet market with stuff like the Nexus and the Kindles and so forth. And so I think the question now is, can they build upon this relatively modest success and become a bigger deal? With phones, we know Android is doing very well, and I expect Android to continue to do well. And with tablets, we'll see. Windows 8 is like another big story for CES and next year.
What do you think? I mean, you've been covering Microsoft for a long, long time. This is the first time, it kind of surprises me even for me to say this out loud, they've ever made a PC. After all these years of selling operating systems and software to PC manufacturers, they're finally making a PC. This is a big bet.
It's a huge bet. And I think the one thing we know for sure is it's going to be a while before we know whether the bet pays off. Like Windows 8 and Surface came out on October 26th, and within about 3 weeks, you saw stories in the news they were doing badly.
Right.
And I'm like, well, Windows 1.0 came out in 1985, and if you had tried to judge how Windows did after 3 weeks, it was doing badly.
Right.
It really took 10 years before Windows started dominating everything when Windows 95 came out. And the world moves more quickly than it did then, but I feel like Windows 8, it's going to be a while. It's going to be months and possibly years before it pays off. And it might be Windows 9 or Windows 10 where it's clear whether it made sense or not.
You think Microsoft has a chance?
I think it's a big bet, and it's either going to end up doing better than everybody expects, or it's going to end up having been a big mistake.
If it's not a hit, it's a flop. I think Microsoft's in the position now where they cannot continue on as they have,
right?
Just kind of grinding it out. They either have to show up or go home.
I mean, they're asking hundreds of millions of people to do something totally new.
I think they did the right thing doing that, by the way.
Yeah, I think they
did. It's gutsy, but I think they had to do that.
But on the other hand, half the world is still using Windows XP after 11 years.
That's true.
And won't even move to Windows 7.
They're not going out of business. They've got a nice, solid line of business. That's no question about it. They're like IBM. I mean, in 20 years, they'll still be selling probably Windows 7.
Microsoft's not going to collapse or anything.
No.
But will they be at the center of the industry? Not clear, and they no longer in the catbird seat. They're kind of the scrappy.
They're number two. They got to try harder. Yeah. Isn't that funny? Who would have thought that?
Depending on which market you're talking about, they're like number three or number four in some cases.
In the cell phone market, they're lucky to be there at all. And yet they have a great product. I think you could argue that Windows Phone 8 is the best of the Windows 8 products.
It's
very,
very
impressive, yeah. But is it enough? Is it timely enough? They have a very big challenge, but Android and iPhone. It's fun. What about BlackBerry? You think they're coming back? Everybody seems to be paying attention all of a sudden to BlackBerry 10 as if maybe there's a shot.
Yeah, I mean, lately you've seen sort of the first slightly optimistic stories about it.
Saw a story today say the browser just smokes.
Yeah, the carriers appear to honestly be excited by it. Essentially, it's not really a war between the iPhone and Android in a lot of ways. It's really a war between Apple and Samsung, who are these two huge companies that are both doing very well. And in theory, at least, the Verizons and AT&Ts of the world would like another competitor besides Apple and Samsung.
Right.
So a third platform, which BlackBerry has.
So the carriers are going to be interested.
This is the theory, at least. Yeah. I mean, they have a huge uphill road ahead of them. But at least they're actually going to ship something soon.
Right.
They've spent the last few years just sort of twiddling their thumbs.
Right. How do you keep out of the bubble? It's unfortunate because people who report on technology, we really are in a bubble. Our relationship with technology is abnormal. We love it more than probably most people do. We care about it. We follow it more closely than most people do. And it's very easy to think that the way you and I and all our friends think is the way real people think. How do you keep from getting in that?
You know, at time, it's really easy because almost all of my colleagues are in New York, and they're not tech reporters. Well, they're actual people of all types.
Right.
And when I write something and turn it in for the magazine, if they don't understand it, I know that I wasn't clear enough. When they start to get interested in stuff, I know it matters to people. Like when they started talking about Pinterest a year ago, I knew that Pinterest was not just something within the Silicon Valley bubble.
Right. One of the things that makes it so hard to predict what's going to happen this year or certainly farther down the road is that technology is full of these paradigm shifts, these discontinuities where everything you know is wrong. It's all changed. Pinterest is a good example of just like, what? Where the hell did that come from? The internet certainly was like that. What do you think the next – I mean, it's impossible to predict because that's the nature of it. What do you think the next big thing might be?
I mean, it's probably the Internet of Things, meaning it's not just about PCs and tablets and phones, which people think of as computing devices.
Right.
It's a world in which everything is a computing device.
Wow.
So your car, your thermostat.
Right. Nest is a good
things
example.
Things like Nest. This is Fitbit, which connects directly to can upload data directly to the Internet without needing a device in the middle.
You know what's stopping that from – I think that could happen today. But what's stopping it is that everybody is siloed, and it's really a problem. For instance, home automation, everybody was sure that was going to take off, but you had four different standards or five different standards. Nothing was dominant, and nothing worked with anything else. So you ended up buying one thing, and that's all that worked. You know, I just got the Philips Hue lights. They have their Zigbee, which is one of the protocols. But it doesn't work. It would be nice if, for instance, I could write an Action script or an Apple script that would tell the lights to dim, the TV to come on. But none of this stuff works with anything else. If it did, the Internet of Things could be amazing. How do we solve that?
Well, hopefully there will be more standards. I mean, in a lot of ways, we live in a more siloed world than we did a few years ago.
It's terrible.
Because there are things like Facebook where if you put your stuff in Facebook, it's kind of siloed there.
Yeah.
And
Twitter is a silo. It's like AOL. It's like 100 AOLs. And it's just as bad in a hardware as well. I mean, your Fitbit would be cool. It would be great if I could have health sensors all over my body that would know all of this stuff and then to a central. But it doesn't. Nothing talks to anything else. The Fitbit just talks to the Fitbit.
I think over time that'll happen.
I hope so.
It's going to be – it'll definitely be better consumers, but it'll also be better for the business.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of money to be made. And where you really see it is in content, where you have the incumbents like Comcast and Verizon holding on for dear life. And it's keeping things like an Apple TV that could really transform how we consume content from happening. Because if Apple can't make the deals with the content creators, they've got nothing.
And that, you know, one of the reasons we're in a little bit more of a siloed world recently, I think, is because everybody's looking at Apple's success, and Apple has been.
And they're the ultimate silo.
Apple is a huge silo that they build the, the content, the services, the software, the hardware, the processor, and that has worked so well for them that everybody's trying to do that.
Eric Schmidt talked about the four horsemen of the internet, the four engines of the internet: Facebook, Apple, Google, and Amazon. He left out Microsoft, and I think that was intentional. Do you agree those are the companies to watch?
Well, I mean, yes, except a lot of the truly disruptive stuff always comes from smaller companies, and all of those companies were quite small when they first started.
That's why it's disruptive. We never heard of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to be Google. What about wearable computing? Are you interested in it? That's kind of part of the Internet of Things, isn't it, if your glasses suddenly are smart?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm excited. I think I agree with you, Harry. This is you couldn't pick a better time to be a technology journalist.
It's a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you're doing a great job. If you go to technologizer.com, that's where you'll find Harry's stuff. And you'll see a lot more of him on Twit and all of our shows because we just think he's one of the most astute observers of this stuff. That's why Technologizer worked, because you knew if Harry wrote a thoughtful, long piece about something, that was going to be the piece to read. And you keep doing that. That's great. We appreciate it. It's nice to see you. Thank you, Harry.
Always a pleasure.
Always fun. We do Triangulation Wednesday afternoons right after Twig, and that's usually around 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. That'd be about midnight UTC. I hope you'll tune in and watch live. We love it, getting the feedback from the chat room. If you can't, though, on-demand versions of the show are available. In fact, we've got 83 shows in the can now, and you can go back and watch each and every one at twit.tv/TRI. You can also subscribe. In fact, I would ask you to do so. It'd be really great if you did, through iTunes or Zune or Dogcatcher or Instacast or whatever it is that you use to keep track of podcasts. We're right in there. Just search for Triangulation. Next week, it's the best of, right? I think we have a best of with a bunch of interesting interviews collated from the last 12 months of shows. I think you're going to enjoy it. You can't possibly have seen them all, and there'll be some gems in there. And then we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode, I guess January 2nd, day after New Year's, yeah, of Triangulation. So thanks for being with us in 2012. We look forward to a great year in 2013. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.